So we're now moving into our next theme for the Sangha nights for the next few months. So since the start of Sangha night in September last year, we were focusing on the system of practice, and we've had a series of talks and workshops and reflections around the series of the system of practice. And now over the next few months, we're moving into our new theme, which is the six paramitas. And in a similar way, we'll spend 3 or 4 weeks with each of the different paramitas over. So it'll take us a few months to cover them all, and we'll approach each of them from different perspectives, talks, reflections, workshop-y things. So we'll have a chance to reflect on all of them. And what I want to do this evening is an overall introduction to launch us into that. And I'd like to do that by, first of all, briefly sort of setting them in a historical context, and also in a context of sort of other lists of stuff. And then I'll go through each of them relatively briefly, but also partly just looking at the aspects that are most sort of front of my experience at the moment, or most inspire me or challenge me around each of them, because they're all very sort of broad themes. So it'll be quite that would be my sort of way into it. But also I'm going to do some requiring audience participation, because you've all studied extensively, or at least most of you have, and so I'm sure you know quite a lot of the lists and stuff. So I will elicit some things as well as we go along. But to start with, to place the six paramitas in historical context, I'm sort of going right back in a way to the sort of really broad picture, and then we'll sort of narrow it down. So you've got the sort of three yanas, the three with Buddhism, the Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and tracking right back to sort of early Buddhism with the Hinayana, there was very much an emphasis on overcoming suffering, that we could move beyond suffering, be liberated from it, and no longer reborn, sort of moving out of that cycle of birth and death and samsara. And talking in terms of the arahant as an enlightened being, the individual who could become enlightened, and very much a sense of liberation from suffering, moving from suffering. And but then what you had coming in on top of that, because I think in a lot of the sort of Buddhism, it's often balancing things out. There's one emphasis, and then things move into another emphasis, and then this, and then this. And so what then with the Mahayana coming in, there was a sense of, okay, well, that's just talking about the person and what can happen to somebody in the path of awakening. But this is bringing in a bigger vision, then inspired very much by the life of the Buddha, and sort of bringing in the bodhisattva, the idea of the bodhisattva, the sort of ideal Buddhist, and very much bringing in the sense of the bodhisattva as the urge to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. That's that sense of sort of going beyond, the idea it was a bigger vision, a much sort of, that's the idea. And with it comes the way that the suttas are written and everything is in a very different way. I mean, I think one of the talks I was listening to in preparation for this was talking about sort of cosmic science fiction. You know, there's lots of sort of emphatic, and there's lots of, what's the word for it? Not exaggerated, but descriptive, lots of embellishments of things. And it's with that, so you've got the bodhisattva and the sort of two aspects of that. In fact, the Bhante talks about very much that you've got the bodhisattva, the sort of vow aspect, that sort of I'm going to, you know, gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings, not rest until all beings are enlightened. And then the establishment aspect of that, and that's where the six paramitas come in, is that idea of the establishment of the bodhisattva. So paramitas as in perfections, virtues, qualities. So they're the six perfections from the sattva, the establishment of the bodhisattva. And so that's sort of historically where they come in. But another thing I wanted to do in terms of setting the scene for them was to talk about lists in Buddhism and the role of lists. And this is a first test, is how many different lists of stuff can we mention here? If you're going to list the five this, the six that, just any, whichever ones come to mind first from any study, what are the different lists you've come across in Buddhism? Four Noble Truths.
Eightfold Path.
The five precepts. Ten precepts.
204. Bodhiyangas.
The seven Bodhiyangas.
Thank you.
Three Lakshanas. Yep.
Five spiritual faculties.
37 Bodhipakshadharmas. Thank you very much. I can
ten
think.
Boomies.
Ten boomies. I was going to say I could think of two more, but that's one of those that come to mind.
Five hindrances.
The Vimokshas, yes.
The Kariyasas.
Oh, yes.
How many are they?
Three or four.
Right. Yes. There's ten fetters. And six paramitas. Yeah. Anyway, that's quite a lot of lists in Buddhism. That's more than I thought of when I was thinking of this talk. And part of it, as I'm sure you know, a lot of you are aware, is that when you're passing down an oral tradition, lists are dead handy, because you can think, oh, there's three Vimokshas, I can think of two of them, what's the third? Or, yep, Eightfold Path, you know, what's... what's all those? So partly it's a very, very useful way to remember and encompass stuff, is to have a list that you can then draw on. But another aspect that I was thinking of in terms of the sort of six paramitas as well, because you've got, so it's a list of the qualities, the virtues of a bodhisattva. And but when I was thinking about it, I was thinking of it in two different ways, which I think applies to a lot of the other lists, such as the five spiritual faculties, the precepts, different lists of qualities, is that, you know, from the perspective of awakening or an awakened being, they're really the natural qualities that you would see, that they would sort of emanate very, very naturally. And they're very helpful qualities to reflect on along a spiritual path. And so, and one of the sort of images I had when I was thinking of that was in the image of the lotus that you get a lot, which I think I've also talked about here. A lotus is the fantastic image, because a lotus comes up, you know, through the mud, and then the lotus flower flowers above the water. So this sense that when we're in the mud and on a spiritual path, and when you use that sort of metaphor of a path, then reflecting on these lists of qualities and ethics and developing those in our lives is a really helpful thing. And then another aspect of them, in a way, is a sort of mandala aspect, the unfolding aspect, the opening out aspect. And that's when, from a perspective of wisdom, from awakening, they sort of naturally unfold in our lives. They're a very natural expression of how to be. You know, they would just be there. So there's that path aspect, unfolding aspect, and that would certainly very much apply to the with the six paramitas. So, coming on to those, what are they? You can remember them offhand. I had to confess I had to check on a couple of them. Dana. Doesn't have to be in order.
Shanti.
Virya, yep.
Sila.
Sila.
Samadhi.
Or Dhyana, Dhyana Samadhi, it's put in different ways, yeah. One more?
Pranya,
thank you. Okay, so those are the six paramitas. And they're often, particularly, Bhante very much talked about them in pairs. So first the sort of the dana and sila as the altruistic and individual aspect, and the virya and kshanti, the masculine and feminine aspects, and then so in sort of three different pairs. So I'm going to go through what each of them are and then just draw out a few things that are front of mind to me, but it won't be a sort of comprehensive introduction to them because we're going to say lots more about them in the next few months and do lots more stuff around them. So to start off with, so you've got dana and sila. So dana, generosity, giving. And there are lots of ways to approach this. So there is another list. A lot of these have lists within lists. We don't have to necessarily do all of them, but there's also a traditional list of what can be given. And I don't know if Pratidya Matty's giving a talk next week on dana, so I don't know if you're going to be including that or not. But in terms of the sort of traditional list of what can be given, I wanted to pick out a couple of things. So some of it goes right from, you know, you can give material things right through to, you know, the willingness to give up your life in order to practice the Dharma. So it's quite a big scope of things. And but two of the things that I wanted to pick out, which resonate very much with me, is that one is that is the gift of confidence, and I think that's a really valuable one, and it's something that can be very much sort of caught more than taught. You know, that by being confident, we can help other people to also be confident. And that links very closely as well to the one of the other gifts, traditional gifts you can give, is the gift of the Dharma. And so actually those two sort of link very closely, that actually that in terms of practicing and teaching and practicing the Dharma, and confidence within that can also help then in terms of confidence of other people. And it's, I mean, so it's one that I've also been quite aware of in terms of raising children, you know, being a parent, in terms of that gift of confidence. Because I think there's a sense, you know, that in terms of fearlessness, if you have that or some aspect of it, then you can sort of, the rest of it, there's an awful lot you can do and you can learn and you can be from that perspective. And I think it was one of the things, one of the gifts that my parents gave us as when they raised us was you know, there wasn't a lot of anxiety around when we were being raised, really. And I think that's a fantastic gift, and one that I was quite consciously trying to sort of pass on to my children, which has meant that I had to do some quite scary things along the way in terms of jumping off cliffs and skiing down mountains and stuff. We're trying not to look scared. And in fact, I can remember with my daughter very early on when we went whitewater kayaking on a family holiday, and one of the things we had to do was lie in the river and be shown what would happen if you fell out of the canoe, out of the kayak, because actually the water just carries you to a safe place. So, and I took my daughter upstream and waded out in front of this great big rock and let go of her. And the instructor was the other end and caught her. But it was she was absolutely terrified. I didn't make her do it, so, you know. But she was completely speechless with fear and absolutely determined to do it. Anyway, she did, and she got caught, and then she was, you know, all excited, because she was the youngest by far. We were with cousins and stuff. And I always remember that when we got back from that holiday, I think I can't remember how old she was, 8 or 9 or something, but we met up with my then partner, who was saying, "Oh, how was it? How was it?" And Ella said, "I faced my fears." You know, and that was the thing that she remembers. And she has, you know, she went off to Latin America on her own for 6 months last year in a gap year, so she's probably worked. But I do, so that's part of it, is that idea of the sort of the gift of fearlessness, the gift of confidence. And linked to that is also the gift of the Dharma, of communicating the Dharma, which is what I'm attempting to do now, what we, you know, all do here in our different ways. And that is also something that is incredibly precious to me. I mean, it's something that I do as much as I am able to within a, 'cause I work as well, but I'm here and doing that as much as I'm able, and outside of here as well, because I think it is the greatest gift that we can give. But also I think the whole the Dana Paramita, I mean, it's a massive, massive topic, and we can also just get a sense of what it feels like, what generosity feels like. You know, we'll all have that. In fact, one of the things a friend of mine always says is that whenever he has a sort of generous urge or generous thought, he makes sure always to act on it. Because sometimes we can have this thought or this urge and then think, oh, no, it'll be embarrassing, or it'll be too much, or this, you know. But always to actually act on it, on the grounds that is, there's a huge amount of energy that can go into that. So that's very much in terms of practicing it. And also, as I was saying at the beginning, there's this sense of, you know, we can actually actively practice these things. So generosity, giving, it's actually often one of the more accessible things to practice, even if it's giving in quite small ways, and even if we don't feel that great or we feel upset or depressed, it is something that's actually possible for everybody to practice. But taken to its sort of ultimate level, when you're looking at it as in an unfolding quality of from an awakened perspective, there it's much more that there isn't, it's not even so much the giving, the giver and the being given to, you know, you can, it's going beyond that duality, self-other duality of where, you know, I am giving to you. It's much more just, there isn't, you know, even, I mean, you can even get a sense of that, I think, sometimes yourselves, as particularly going beyond, you know, when you're feeling more open, you can get a sense of that. For example, there's a friend of mine who's got a lot of difficulty with her body at the moment, and in fact, on Friday, needed to go for an operation, and I sort of took her and waited with her and things. And it's, you know, in those sorts of situations, it doesn't feel like a sort of that sort of self-other, I'm doing this for you. It's just more like, you know, a person needing to be somewhere, another person that's able to take. It felt, I don't know if that makes sense or whether you've had that sense, but it doesn't feel so much in the dual aspect of it. I'm going to speed up now. And so that's Dana, and we'll do much more on the Dana Paramita, the quality. And then, so looking at it from that sort of altruistic and then individual aspect, you've got the Sila, uprightness, and that's where we're coming into the whole area of ethics. And we've got the five precepts, which I'm not going to go into in detail, but there were just a couple of things that I wanted to pick out in terms of ethics. And one of them is that, in a way, the motivation to behave ethically will also depend where we are on a spiritual path and within that sort of unfolding. And it can start off by, in a way, being very, you know, wanting to behave ethically. Well, partly in terms of having an easier life, having a less complicated life, doing the right thing. It may also be wanting to be seen to be good. This can be all sorts of reasons. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter why we start wanting to behave more ethically in our lives. It really doesn't matter. But as we move along the path, as things start to unfold, that motivation can change, and there can be a much more of a natural empathy. There can be much more awareness of, well, actually, in behaving unethically, it's causing ourselves pain. So it's not so much even about, you know, doing the wrong thing to someone else. It's realizing, you know, that harms us. And this is classically very linked to meditation, that you find that actually, if your behavior is not ethical, it's harder and harder to go deeper and deeper in meditation, because things just come up and they lurk and they get in the way, and then you have to address them, and it all just has a momentum of its own. And also the sense that actually the more there's a sense of wisdom and unfolding happening, the more it's just like that's the natural way to be. Ethics becomes a very natural expression, and there's less sort of effort involved in having to make yourself behave ethically, because in a way we sort of strip away a lot of the reasons that might cause us to behave unethically. All the things, all the motivations can sort of start to drop away. So that's the dana and sila aspects, the first two. And then the third and fourth, which can go together, so virya and kshanti. So virya, energy, that sense of energy, but very much in terms of energy in pursuit of the good. So the positive energy. And what we'll all find is that the other reason that there are lots of different lists, and there's lots of lists where you've got paired qualities, for example, like you've got here virya and kshanti. So virya, energy in pursuit of the good. Kshanti is about patience, tolerance, forbearance. And those are the ones that Bhante is framing as the masculinity and femininity, though that's obviously very broad. It doesn't necessarily mean men and women. It's just very broad sort of qualities. But the way you've got a lot of these qualities that can be paired in different lists is because we'll all have different things that come really naturally to us, and things that we need to work on more consciously. So you may find that, you know, there's quite a lot of natural energy, but, you know, for me, I find it easier to access energy than patience, for example. And but I think one of the things I wanted to draw out in terms of virya was that in a way, you know, energy will be there. You know, we have energy. There is energy. It's more about it can get blocked, or it can be it can become just very scattered, or it can be misused. So those are all the those are broadly in terms of three reasons that we may not experience an enormous amount of virya or energy in pursuit of the good, because it's getting, you know, it might be blocked by all sorts of things. I mean, in part that might be partly just not things not being quite right in life, or it might be to do with all sorts of conditioning that's happened from how we're raised. It could be also, it's not a blame aspect. It can be just that there's lots of stuff there. So there may be a sort of a process to go through for some of that unblocking. Sometimes you'll have, I mean, I've had a sense certainly with meditation where it's very much like a sort of a manhole cover just about here, and there's an awful lot, you know, and having that sense of things being held down, there's quite a lot of block, you know, and also having the sense of that starting to shift and move and seeing some of the things underneath it. And dissipating can be just that our energy is too scattered, we do too much stuff. or we're doing a lot of stuff that's just headed in the wrong, you know, in a direction that's not very helpful to us. And then, so there's that, and then the sort of the patience, forbearance, tolerance. I mean, forbearance is a really interesting word that no doubt we will unpick when we get to that aspect, when we're looking at it in terms of the evenings and going through them. Because it's not traditionally, it's not a very attractive or quality sometimes, but I think it's a really fascinating aspect of it in terms of unpicking what that actually means. And very much also the patience. I mean, I've had, that's the sort of the main thing in a way that I still struggle with, is impatience, particularly come out in a work context, and sometimes not so much now in a family context, it used to. But also some of these things, it can be quite interesting if we have got a strong experience of them, is to look underneath them and look at sometimes the views that we hold that can hold them in place. And I had something that quite recently with patience that came up, where I realised that I had a view, because sometimes if things really lurk, you know, that it's sometimes that there's a view there, that there's something sort of stuck there. And one of the things I realised is that there was a view for me underlying patience. And it was that, for example, my father, who died 4 years ago, he was a very bright man, and he was one of these people that we euphemistically said at his funeral doesn't suffer fools gladly, you know, in other words, irritable bugger. And I realised to my shame, actually, a few months ago, that I had a view underlining this impatience, which was linked to this not suffering fools gladly, linked to somehow that was all right. You know, because it was sort of all right for him, and we loved him anyway. It somehow that it seemed to be all right. It was a natural part of, that somehow that was all right. Which was quite shocking for me to realise that this view was there. And actually, since seeing it more clearly, it did start to shift it quite a lot in terms of the impatience. I mean, it still arises, but not. Not with us, yeah. It's really, really start to shift with that, and which I think links back to something I meant to say around the ethics, the Sila thing as well, which is that it's picking out that actually in Buddhism, I think one of the other things I really like around the sort of ethics, the Sila, is that there's the sort of whole idea of hri and apatrapia. The sort of hri is the sort of positive shame, you know, that and apatrapia, which is the when it's sort of, you can sort of see your actions through the eyes of somebody that you see as quite spiritually advanced, and you just think, oh no, it doesn't really stack up. And that's certainly what happened to me in terms of seeing this view around impatience and free, that sort of positive shame. So there isn't guilt, there isn't let's beat ourselves up, the sort of remorse, shame aspect that can be very positive and really help shift things, rather than rather than beat ourselves up, which is just unhelpful. Anything we do is entirely human, and it can be helpful to see those things. So finally, quickly, in terms of the sort of dhyana meditation, that can be one of the ways into that is also looking at in terms of the sort of levels of absorption in meditation. And one of the things I wanted to pull out in this sense, which I'll do quite quickly, is around. So we're talking about dhyana, sort of levels of absorption, of concentration. And so for some people can access those states in meditation very easily, and some people don't. And in a way, it doesn't really seem to matter much whether you can or can't in terms of meditation transforming us. But where we can sort of become more absorbed, it can be quite helpful for, and there's sort of four reasons, another sort of list that I was thinking about. And one is that because when we start to feel more concentrated, it's a bit like sort of stabilizing the mind. So instead of trying to look through a lens that's shaking, we can just sort of stabilize the mind, see more clearly, which is very helpful for insight practice. It can also be quite sort of healing psychologically. So we sort of become integrated both sort of horizontally and vertically. It can also be just a sort of welcome vacation from stress. So, so just a more sort of sane, healthy way of being. And can help in terms of a sort of mental stability that's giving us a sort of mental stability that when we start looking and doing insight practice, that can be a very sort of helpful, stabilizing thing as well. And then, so finally, in terms of pranya, the sort of the sixth paramita, which again we'll go into quite a bit when we get to that, but it's so pranya, wisdom, in terms of seeing things clearly, understanding the reality of things, and very much looking at it in terms of a direct experience of reality, of how things actually are, of truth, rather than an intellectual understanding of them. And from the and that means in terms of very much those lists of the three lakshanas, the four noble truths. So experiencing directly that things are insubstantial, impermanent, and therefore unsatisfactory. And though that sort of, and very much sort of seeing that reality very directly can come in all sorts of ways. It can come, it can be a sort of a spontaneous spiritual experience of seeing that clearly. It can come through suffering. It can come through sort of meditation and sort of insight practice of actually looking directly at the nature of experience and seeing it in that light, seeing the insubstantiality of it. But it's something that we can sort of practice very explicitly, sort of both in terms of insight practice, looking directly alongside the meditation, dhyana, samatha aspects of it. And so those are the six paramitas. It's a sort of a bit of a gallop through the six paramitas. So setting them up in terms of seeing them within that the context of the establishment aspect of the bodhisattva within Mahayana Buddhism, and those six different qualities of the bodhisattva, the dana, generosity, sila, uprightness or ethics, virya, energy in pursuit of the good, kshanti, tolerance, forbearance, patience, dhyana, meditation, and pranya, wisdom, insight into reality. So that is going to be our theme for the next few months. So we'll probably spend 3 or 4 weeks, I think, on each. So thank you very much.